The Science Show from AAAS, and San Jose is, as I said, IT central. So an obvious place to ask, what is the future of the internet? And here are three IT superstars to answer that. Vint Cerf from Google, David Oran from Cisco Systems, and Glenn Edens from Xerox. And we start with Vint Cerf, Vice President of Google.
So if we're thinking 1,000 years, 3,000 years in the future, we have to ask ourselves, how do we preserve all of the bits that we need in order to correctly interpret the digital objects that we create? If we don't find a solution to that problem, our 21st century will become an information black hole. The 22nd century and the future centuries after that will wonder about us, but they'll have great difficulty knowing much, because so much of what we have left behind may be bits that are uninterpretable. So I'm going to be describing a system developed by a colleague at Carnegie Mellon University. The project is called Olive, like the thing you stick into your cocktail glass, and it is a way of preserving operating systems and application software and descriptions of hardware so that the environment in which your digital objects exist can be recreated in the future. So we hope that 3,000 years from now, when you're running Windows 3000 and you do a Google search and you pull up a 1997 PowerPoint file, that you'll actually be able to display it and see what was going on at the end of the previous century. So, Glenn, you're on.
Great, thank you. And again, welcome. Some of our early results at Xerox PARC have indicated that there's some real potential for information-centric networking and our particular implementation, which is called CCN or content-centric networking, to really maybe address some of the issues that the internet faces going forward. And we're talking really about the plumbing issues. How do we better deal with security? How do we better deal with network efficiency? And how do we make networks more responsive to what society wants to do with them? Just a little plug, PARC's been in the networking world for almost as long as Vint, not quite, but we had this little project called Ethernet, which I think certainly changed the world. And so we've been working in networking for a long time. PARC's been involved in many of the developments, and it's pretty exciting. And real briefly, one sentence, what we basically attempt to do is replace the addressing mechanism of the internet, which has worked so well, but we replace that with a mechanism that uses the names of content to try to access information throughout the network.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is David Oran, and I'm a fellow at Cisco Systems. I run a small research organization in Cambridge, Mass. Cisco's been interested in making sure that as the internet evolves, the underlying equipment, the protocols, and management and organizational systems that surround the internet can evolve as quickly as we need it to as the needs change. So we've been looking, as has PARC, into the possible applicability of information-centric networking techniques to either augment or potentially, it's possible, replace some of the protocols that underpin the internet today. There's commercial reasons why we might be interested in this, partly that if it happens to work very well, it puts about 80% of our product line at risk. And what some of the really difficult research challenges are. One is that today's internet has a very large address space, particularly if you consider IPv6. But if you look at the actual routing system that is used to move packets around the internet, its scale is order of 10 to the 9th, maybe in some number of years, 10 to the 10th objects. We route to subnets, and there's about a billion or 10 billion of those. If instead you route directly to information objects, the number of those that simultaneously might exist, and as Vint points out, might need to exist for hundreds to thousands of years, is 2 to 3 orders of magnitude beyond that. Some estimates show 10 to the 12th objects, some, depending on how granular you are, talked about 10 to the 15th objects. We have no idea how to build a routing system that will scale to that kind of size. So there's interesting research there. The second area of challenge is in security. The current internet has gotten maybe not the greatest reputation in terms of its security properties. Partly that's because security was kind of added on to the protocol system over the years. Part of it is potentially due to some decisions about the actual architecture of the internet in terms of what is secured and how it's secured. So in information-centric networking, there's an attempt to reformulate the security model to be one of securing the actual information objects as opposed to securing the information channels that communicate those information objects. And such a system has very different properties from the one we're used to. It's not necessarily better, it's just different. And understanding the differences in those properties and what consequences that has for how we formulate the security of the internet years down the line, I think, is a productive area of research.
So one of the things that Glenn is going after in part is a problem that you should all be sensitive to. Domain names are not necessarily a stable naming mechanism. And the reason is that companies can go out of business and the domain name no longer works. And so if you have something that's identified by a domain name or a URL, HTTPS, etc., it may no longer resolve. So these are not necessarily stable identifiers. And one of the big issues associated with an accumulating amount of information is finding stuff. So the information-centric idea might help us deal with that. And the thing that David mentioned about the security in general, we speak of the internet isn't secure. I hope we can be a little more nuanced in the layered view of things. Most of the real weaknesses tend to be at the edges of the net where people use passwords that aren't very good, where operating systems are penetrated. Although I also accept that there are attacks against the network infrastructure itself, the routers, for example, and the domain name system. So there's lots of work to be done to make the network more secure. And anything that would shift its architecture in the direction of a more easily secured environment would probably be a good thing for all of us.
But what about that black hole that Vince Cerf mentioned? What's that about?
Let me give you a very simple scenario. Some of you will have read a book called A Team of Rivals by Doris Kearns Goodwin. And if you've read it, I hope you reacted like I did. It was an amazing book. But what was interesting is that she appeared to reproduce the conversations of the times between the principals. And of course, she wasn't there in the mid-1800s, so how did she do that? And the answer is that she went to some number of libraries, it could be 100 of them for all I know, and found the correspondence among the principals and understood not only what topics they were discussing, but what they had to say about them. And then she reproduced the dialogue in her book. Now, let us imagine that there's a 22nd century Doris Kearns Goodwin, and she decides she wants to write about the beginnings of the 21st century. And she now seeks to reproduce the conversations of the time and discovers that it's email and tweets. Well, maybe the tweets will be around if the Library of Congress actually hangs on to all that. But there's an awful lot of digital content that either will have evaporated because nobody saved it, or it will be around, but it won't be interpretable because it was created with software that's 100 years old, and she doesn't have any machines that could run that software. So what I'm getting at here is that her ability to do a good job will be dependent on her ability to get access to material in a form that is presentable or renderable. There is another issue here, and it's not just about historians. There is information which is vital to the way our societies work. And to give you a concrete example of that, it's real estate transactions that need to be recorded. In the future, that might be patent transactions and transfers, copyright applications and transfers. If these are all done electronically, and if we aren't thoughtful about making sure that the information contained in those transfers is preserved over long periods of time, then we may be in real trouble. And while you might say, well, let's just print all the stuff out, I want to alert you to the fact that not everything that is digital today is static. There is a lot of stuff that's actually very dynamic, like software, that has to be executed in order to make something happen. So it's not just like movies, it's more like video games. It's like interactive software that lets you evaluate and analyze. And that's the thing that she faces. She faces this serious potential deficit of access to important information. So we're going to have to build into our thinking the concept of preservation writ large, not just the bits, but also all the software that goes with it. And maybe we will have to build into the legal system a concept of preservation having rights in the same way that fair use has rights associated with copyright that in some ways penetrate the normal copyright shield. And so the party who is acting to preserve might need to have legal basis for rights to hold copies of software, copies of documents, copies of machine architectures and designs.
Fiona McRae, Daily Mail. I just wonder if it seems ironic to you that information on scrolls and stone tablets from ancient times when the technology was a lot less evolved still exists and is still readable, and yet the information we're storing today may disappear.
Believe me, I've had embarrassing moments when I wandered in with my DVD or Blu-ray and I'm raving about 4.7 gigabytes, and the librarian walks away, comes back from the stacks with a 1,000-year-old vellum manuscript, puts it down, and then says sweetly, "And how long do you think your polycarbonate disc is going to last?" And even if I said, well, it might be 20 years, she says, and do you think that the thing that reads it will still be around in 20 years? And so you're quite right. In our zeal to get excited about digitizing, like we digitize photographs thinking it's going to make them last longer. And we might turn out to be wrong unless we actually figure out how to solve this problem. So you're right. It's very ironic, but that's what engineers like. You know, they like the challenge of trying to make the future different from what it looks like it might be.
So I have a quick test. Show of hands, how many people have had trouble opening not that old iWork documents from Apple or Microsoft Word documents?
Yeah, my photographs keep, you know, the little black thing comes up saying, I don't know how to interpret this format. So it's already a problem. And it isn't even 10 years, let alone 50 or 100 or 1,000.
I find it frightening that we might be able to preserve everything. A vast majority of stuff that exists in the digital world is not worth preserving. It wasn't worth preserving from yesterday to today, and it definitely will not be worth preserving for another 1,000 years. We have solved that problem historically in some things. I got to see that within this past year a contemporary photograph of Abraham Lincoln, and people had gone to great lengths to preserve that in pristine condition because it was worth preserving. But are we contemplating any system of logic that might distinguish something that is very worth preserving, something that might be worth preserving, or something that we can pretty darn well say we'd rather see this disappear forever?
So do you have any friends that are historians by any chance? I'll tell you what happens when you raise that particular argument with serious historians. The first thing they'll tell you, after you get them down off the ceiling, is that sometimes we actually don't know what bit of information might turn out to be very important, an insight that we wouldn't have gotten were it not for the fact that by sheer happenstance, a particular scrap of some kind was preserved. And maybe there are things that we could tag as throw this away after 10 days. And you'll notice that in the legal world, there's a great deal of desire to cause email to disappear by policy after a certain amount of time, which might have preserved the Sony people a lot of embarrassment if it had been implemented that way. So there may be practices that address the issue that you're raising, but I want to be careful that we are not too arrogant about declaring that this is important and valuable and this is not. David?
So my spouse is an historian, and I think she would be on the same page as Vin. At the time information is created and archived, understanding what in fact is worth preserving and what isn't, there's a lot of history that was written by victors that would be written differently had the vanquished's materials not been destroyed. One thing I will mention is that, as Vin pointed out, that the software needs to be preserved in order to be able to interpret the information. There's an interesting subtle security problem here as well, which means you have to be able to have integrity and encryption keys
yes.
that verify the authenticity of information and potentially protect it from a privacy point of view that have the same longevity as the software and the information itself. I don't know how fundamental it is, but I think if you asked someone who is a cryptographer whether they could design a crypto system in which keys never wore out, and that could never be broken.
No such thing.
And those things could not be preserved in the exact bits that represent that keying forever or for hundreds of thousands of years. They would say, I don't think so. Maybe there'll be some breakthrough. So just like we need for long-term preservation a system that preserves the bits themselves and the software, we also need the ability to what's called rekey. We need to be able to re-integrity protect and re-encrypt information securely or have some form of a keying system that can renew keys. If in order to do that, we actually have to reread all of the information in order to go through that process, you wind up with at least a linear increase in computational load and possibly a superlinear increase in computation load. This is a problem that I think has to be thought about in the same context as this preservation of software and the underlying bits.
This is typical of Dave to make the problem harder for the good of all mankind. Thank you, David.
The Future of the Internet with Vince Cerf from Google, Glenn Edens from Xerox, and David Oran from Cisco Systems, all at the AAAS this week in San Jose. Next week, another AAAS feature, how fracking can cause earthquakes, often big ones. And we go to Lord Howe Island in search of more plastic. In Catalyst on ABC Television on Tuesday at 8, how hard is face recognition at airports and border security? And anti-venom for spider and snake bites. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher and Michelle Watts. I'm Robin Williams.